Welcome to Her Story, a project by Chick History. I'm your host, Rebecca Price. For 1 year, we asked 50 contemporary women to share the story of the historical woman who has inspired her. Join us every week for a new story of inspiration, from the headliners to the lesser-known gems.
Dust off the books, read all the letters, preserve with time. Dig out the truth written between the lines. Her history cannot be left behind. She shall not be forgotten.
Joining us today for Her Story number 45 is Maggie Marconi. Maggie is the museum administrator for the Follett House Museum, a branch of the Sandusky Library located in Ohio. As the sole museum professional, Maggie does it all: programming, exhibit design, research, registrarial duties, grant writing, and maintenance. She's a graduate of Earlham College and holds a Master's of Arts from the Cooperstown Graduate Program in History Museum Studies, and she attended the Seminar for Historical Administration in 2006. She is also the president of the Ohio Local History Alliance and serves as the chair of the Small Museums Committee for the American Association for State and Local History. Maggie, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And which woman are you going to share with us today?
Today, I would like to talk about Alice Paul.
Well, please tell us all a little bit about the infamous Alice Paul.
Alice Stokes Paul was born on January 11th, 1885. She was born in Mount Laurel, Pennsylvania. Her mother, Tacy, attended Swarthmore College, and actually her grandfather, Tacy's father, helped found Swarthmore. Her father, William, was a banker. They were Hicksite Quakers, and Hicksite Quakers believed in gender equality. They encouraged education for both men and women, and they also encouraged people to work for the betterment of society. And while Alice was growing up, her mother would often attend suffrage meetings, and Alice would tag along with her, so she was exposed to the suffrage movement as a young girl. In 1901, when Alice was 16 years old, she went to Swarthmore College and she studied biology. And her senior year, she took a politics class, and that was really the beginning of her journey towards social activism. She graduated from Swarthmore in 1905. After her graduation, she attended school in New York City. She wanted to study social work. She studied at the New York School of Philanthropy. And while she was there, she found that social work was a way to help people one at a time. And while she felt in her heart that it was important to help everyone, she was a little frustrated with social work because the scale was so limited. And she really wanted to find a way to help many people at once. And this too contributed towards her later actions. After she was done in New York City, she returned home to Pennsylvania. She went to Philadelphia to the University of Pennsylvania, which is where she received a Master of Arts and a PhD in Sociology. In 1907, she won a scholarship to attend the Woodbrook Settlement for social work in England. And this is really where she got exposed to some beginning suffrage activities. She attended a speech by Emmeline Pankhurst, who was the founder of the British suffrage movement. And Emmeline Pankhurst advocated for increasingly radical tactics for suffrage. So she encouraged women to do things like throw rocks at buildings. And this was where Alice saw the effect of militant suffrage activities. She began to take part in them herself. She was involved in all kinds of different things that resulted in her getting arrested 10 different times. She ended up serving 3 jail terms while she was in England. And while she was in England, in fact, while she was at a police station under arrest, she met Lucy Burns. And Lucy Burns was a fellow American, and they became friends. And while they were in England, they began to demonstrate together. When the two of them returned home to the United States, they started to look for ways that they could work towards national suffrage for women. In the fall of 1912, Alice and Lucy joined forces with the National American Women's Suffrage Association. They were hoping that they could change the direction of the suffrage movement by directly lobbying congressmen. Prior to that, that organization had been working with each state individually, but Alice and Lucy wanted to work on a more national scale. On March 3rd, 1913, which was the day before Woodrow Wilson was to be inaugurated, Alice Paul organized a suffrage parade. This was an unprecedented parade. She hoped that by putting on this massive show that she could convince incoming President Wilson to give women the vote. This parade was something else. There were 500,000 people who watched it. There were 26 floats. There were 10 bands, and 8,000 women marched in this parade. All of the women were wearing white. They were walking together silently down the street, marching towards Pennsylvania Avenue and hoping for the right to vote. The parade was led by a well-known lawyer at the time. Her name was Inez Milholland, and she was dressed in a long white cape and gown. She was riding a white horse. So quite a visual show that they put on. The parade generated a huge amount of publicity, and this created an opening for them to lobby Congress and the president. In fact, it created so much publicity that 4 days after the parade, Alice and her fellow suffragists met with the newly inaugurated President Wilson. He listened to them and their plea for the vote, but he basically put them off. In 1916, the Congressional Union for Women's Suffrage and the Women's Party merged into the National Women's Party. And this was really a moment of big change for the movement. They stopped with their kind of polite and less aggressive tactics, and they decided that they were going to get more aggressive. They shifted gears. They decided to become more militaristic. And this echoed back to their time in England, what Alice and Lucy had learned in England. So in January 1917, the National Women's Party began picketing the White House. And I'm sure everyone has seen these photos. They are in all of our history textbooks when we were kids, of these women standing in front of the White House. They stood there quietly protesting. They carried signs with slogans that were geared towards President Wilson. They were written and out in the colors of the movement, which were yellow and purple. And the signs were asking the president, "Mr. President, what will you do for women's suffrage?" So they had all kinds of different signs like that, and they were hoping to get his attention, but nobody really paid them much mind. So they went on like this, picketing every single day, or 6 days a week, rather. They picketed 6 days a week. No one paid them any mind. So generally, they were ignored until the Great War began. With the declaration of war, the women began using the president's quotes against him, and they were starting to ask some pretty difficult questions. And it was at this point when they were no longer viewed as harmless ladies who were picketing in front of the White House, they had really started to create a scene. A lot of people believed that their actions were very unpatriotic. There were protesters who began taunting and attempting to provoke the women. And at this point, the police began to arrest them. They were arresting them on charges of obstructing traffic. That year, in October, they arrested Alice Paul, and they sentenced her to 7 months in jail. And what they were hoping to do was that by arresting Alice Paul, they could make an example of her. In jail, they put Alice into solitary confinement. And while she was there, she began a hunger strike. When she was released from solitary confinement, she was so weak from not eating that they immediately sent her to the prison hospital. There were other women who were imprisoned, and they joined Alice in the hunger strike because it was the only means of protest that was available to them in jail. Alice never faltered. She continued not to eat, and during the final week of her 3-week hunger strike, the doctors took matters into their own hands, and they placed a tube into her nose, ran it down her throat into her stomach, and 3 times a day they would force feed her. And in spite of this brutal treatment, Alice refused to eat to the end of her hunger strike. Now, all the time that Alice was in jail, there were still women on the outside who were still protesting. They continued to be arrested for demonstrating for suffrage. 33 women were convicted, and they were placed in a workhouse. These women were treated very terribly. They lived in filthy conditions, and on one evening, many of them were very brutally beaten by prison guards. You can imagine that when the news of this terrible mistreatment went out to the media, that it created quite a stir, and it created support for the women, too. And it was under pressure from the public that the suffragists were released in late September 1917. The day before the vote on the amendment, President Wilson announced his support of the amendment. The House of Representatives narrowly passed the amendment, but it failed by 2 votes in the Senate. So to gain momentum, the National Women's Party urged voters to vote against anti-suffrage senators who were up for election that fall. As a result of their actions, Congress was composed of mostly pro-suffrage members. The House again voted for the amendment, and the Senate passed it by one vote. So then the waiting began for the ratification. They needed 36 states to ratify it, and on August 26, 1920, the last state needed to ratify it did so, and that state was Tennessee. So the newly enfranchised women of the United States were able to cast their very first ballots in the 1920 presidential election. The fight for women to gain the vote had started in 1848 in Seneca Falls, and it had finally been successful. Now, a lot of women who had been active in the suffrage movement kind of fell away. You know, they got the vote, that was what they were working for, they were done, and went back to their lives. Alice Paul didn't stop there. She continued to be very active in women's issues. In 1922, Alice enrolled in the Washington College of Law, and she soon introduced the first Equal Rights Amendment. It didn't pass, so she introduced it again, and she introduced it over and over and over until finally, in 1970, it went through Congress successfully. The Equal Rights Amendment wasn't ratified within the required time limit, however, so it failed. She continued her work. She actually went outside the borders of the United States, and she worked with the League of Nations to improve the lives of women around the world. She did eventually return her focus back to women in the United States and to their health, to their well-being, to anything she could help women with. Alice Paul devoted her life to making the lives of women around the world better. She sought enfranchisement for them, equal treatment for women. Along the way, this meant that she gave up a lot of the things were expected of women in that era, that particularly included marriage and a family. In her old age, she had very little and she was largely forgotten. She died at the age of 92 in 1977 of heart failure.
And why did you pick Alice as your inspirational woman in history?
I am inspired by Alice Paul because she wasn't afraid to do unconventional things. She was a woman with a voice and an opinion at a time when women were generally expected to quietly keep homes for their husbands. She wanted to make life better for all women. She didn't just want to work individually with women she might encounter personally. She wanted to paint broad brushstrokes. To do that, she boldly went to Washington, D.C. as a young woman. She found herself arrested. She was imprisoned. She was cruelly treated for trying to be an advocate for American women. I really admire her courage and her willingness to stick with her convictions, even though it caused her great personal suffering. She was devoted to the cause of bettering women's lives until the end of her own life. After her imprisonment and her forced feeding, she gave cell door-shaped pins to the other women who had been imprisoned with her for picketing the White House. There's a few of those in museum collections today. I own a reproduction of this pin, and I enjoy wearing it, and people often ask me about it because it's an interesting little piece, and I really enjoy sharing the story of Alice Paul because I think a lot of people today don't know about her. I almost always wear it on Election Day with great pride as I cast my vote. I, like many of my fellow Americans, do not take the right to vote lightly. I always vote in every election. One very memorable election for me was the year that I was studying abroad. Last November, I filled out my ballot and I sent it home covered in French stamps. There was an issue on the ballot that year for a library levy that was very important to me, and I voted for it. And I had to wait and wait and wait because that was before people were using the internet too much, and I had to wait for a phone call or a letter from home to learn what the results were. And it was so exciting that even though I was so far away from home, I could still cast my vote and make a difference in my home community. I was so excited to learn that the issue did pass and to hear about all the celebrations that were held. I wouldn't have been able to do that without Alice Paul. She helped make sure that my vote and my voice is heard, and for that I'm truly grateful.
Now, what about a book? Is there something that you would recommend to listeners so that they can start learning more about her?
There are all kinds of resources available about Alice Paul. One book that folks might want to check out is called A Women's Crusade, Alice Paul and the Battle for the Ballot. This particular book especially covers the very intense years that were leading right up to the passage of the 19th Amendment. Of course, the battle for suffrage began much earlier in the 1840s and 50s with Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, but this focuses more closely on the Washington years with Alice Paul. And I also have a movie recommendation. There's a movie called Iron-Jawed Angel, which was put out by HBO. And like the book that I mentioned, it too pretty closely covers those years leading up to the passage of the 19th Amendment. So I would recommend either one of those for someone who would like to learn a little bit more.
Maggie, those are excellent recommendations. And I also think that we should say that Maggie is a descendant of Her Story Number 7, who is Anne Hutchinson.
Well, I am a descendant of someone who left with Anne Hutchinson.
Oh.
And I have a definite connection. So they made the difficult decision to leave their homes and to follow her to a new place and reestablish themselves because they believed in what she was doing.
And were they involved in the massacre that killed Anne Hutchinson?
They survived. They did survive. And thus I'm here today.
Okay, got it. Well, if you want to learn more about Anne Hutchinson and this woman that Maggie's ancestors followed around, you can listen to Her Story Number 7. And for Alice Paul, there you have it. Maggie, thank you so much for sharing her story with us.
It was my great pleasure. Thank you.
To learn more about her story and other projects by Chick History, you can visit the website chickhistory.com. And please join us every week for another story of an inspirational woman in history.
I'm here to tell a story, something precious and fine, about a woman who made a difference with her life. She might not be known, but to only a few, her story remembered here is gonna change that view. Her history cannot be left behind. She shall not be forgotten. Her story not forgotten.